From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. According to Lester Brown, we're all in the middle of World War III, not a war of country against country, but one of mankind against the further deterioration of our environment. Brown's World Watch Institute monitors the ozone layer, the global warming trend, and other factors that threaten life on the planet. On today's Fresh Air, Lester Brown on the state of the Earth. Also today, we meet one of the stars of early rock and roll, Little Anthony. Jazz pianist and composer Kenny Barron joins us in our weekly performance spot. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone looks at the new traditionalism in popular culture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest Lester Brown has some good news and some bad news about the environment, but most of it isn't very good. Brown is the founder and president of the World Watch Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank which monitors the global environment. Since 1984, they've issued annual State of the World reports, which analyze the world's ecological health and advocate global policies to curb environmental deterioration. The producers of public television's Nova are developing a 10-part series based on the State of the World report. I asked Lester Brown how the findings of this year's State of the World report compare with those of last.
The thing that I think distinguished the 1989 report from the five predecessor volumes was that the evidence of stress on the Earth's natural systems and resources is becoming more dramatic. We saw it in the form of record heat and drought in the United States, for example, the Mississippi River flow being at the lowest level since record-keeping began a century or so ago, the United States actually having a food deficit in 1988 in terms of current account. The forest fires as a result of the extreme dryness, and we saw Bangladesh two-thirds underwater for several days in September, again because of deforestation and possibly because of increased snowmelt in the Himalayas because of intense heat in Central Asia. In Central China, for several days in a row, the temperature went over 100 degrees, between 100 and 104 degrees. Hospitals in the major cities in central China, Shanghai, Wuhan, Nanjing, were overwhelmed with heat stroke victims, for example. These are societies exposed to record heat who do not have air conditioning. We saw, as a result of satellite photographs, we discovered that the burning of the Amazon was proceeding far more rapidly than anyone had previously estimated. We found Americans going to the beach in the summer only to discover that it was not safe to go in the water. Just a whole host of things affecting people far beyond the sort of environmental hardcore of our society. I think when we look back at 1988, we will see it as the year in which environmental issues moved on to page one of newspapers.
Well, let's look at the climate. A lot of your report is devoted to ozone depletion and the greenhouse effect. Are we looking at permanent climate changes? Do we have any evidence that the temperature is on the rise to stay?
There is certainly evidence that the warming is underway, but there's no way that one can say that with 100% scientific certainty that it's underway, because none of the things that have happened during the 80s, for example, are that different from things that have happened before. For example, the heat and drought of 1988 was not too different than that in 1934 or 1936. But I think the overwhelming opinion among the country's leading meteorologists is that the odds are quite strong that the warming is underway. They cite, for example, the fact that the five warmest years in the past 100 for the world as a whole have all occurred during the 1980s.
And is this attributable to what's been called the greenhouse effect?
That's the general feeling. The level of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases have been building since the Industrial Revolution began, slowly at first, and then much more rapidly over the last generation. Whether the warming is in fact caused by the buildup in greenhouse gases, no one can be absolutely certain. But what has happened in the 80s is what the meteorological models indicate we should expect to happen as a result of the greenhouse gas buildup.
Can you explain how the buildup of gases like carbon dioxide is responsible for the greenhouse effect?
Well, very simply, the presence of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere affects the way in which light comes in and from the sun and reaches the Earth's surface, and then how heat goes out. Carbon dioxide tends to, let me put it this way, light goes through carbon dioxide very easily, but heat does not. And so as the amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere increases, it traps more and more heat close to the Earth, hence the so-called greenhouse effect.
Now, what else is causing this to happen? Deforestation, for instance.
Well, the principal cause of the buildup of carbon dioxide is the use of fossil fuels, oil and coal and natural gas. Each year, we're putting about 7 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide, either as a result of burning fossil fuels or deforestation, that is, burning wood in excess of the rate of new growth. So of that 7 billion tons, about 5.5 billion tons is fossil fuel, and about 1.5 billion tons is estimated to be deforestation. I might also add there are some other greenhouse gases like CFCs, the CFCs that are depleting the ozone layer that protects us from ultraviolet radiation, are also greenhouse gases. The methane is yet another greenhouse gas.
One of the things that you look at in your annual State of the World report is the interconnectedness of things. If the climate is changing, and if it is changing because of the greenhouse effect, what kinds of other changes will that cause environmentally?
Well, the greenhouse effect, of course, will alter the Earth's climate, leading to a general warming of the Earth. It will lead to many more hot and dry summers, such as the United States experienced in 1988. The overall warming will be concentrated more in the higher latitudes, which is where we live. The warming will not be very dramatic at all close to the equator. The projections are that when the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which has increased about 30% since the Industrial Revolution began, when it doubles somewhere around 2030 to 2050, we can expect the average temperature on Earth to be 3 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit higher than it is now. But in the higher latitudes where we live, the increase will be substantially greater than that. This, of course, will affect agriculture. We saw what a hot, dry summer would do for U.S. agriculture this past year. In 1988, probably for the first time in our history, we did not produce enough grain to satisfy our own needs. Now, that 10 million ton shortfall is not a major problem because we simply took that out of our reserves. Given the fact that world grain reserves are now at the lowest level in many, many years, the question that everyone is asking is what if? What if we have another drought in 1989, similar to the one we had in 1988? And the answer to that question is that for the first time since North America emerged as the world's breadbasket more than half a century ago, we would not have much, if any, grain to export. This would mean that by September, the over 100 countries that normally import grain from us would be engaged in a frantic scramble for meager exportable supplies of grain from France, Argentina, and Australia. World grain prices would soar. No one knows how much they would go up. They might double, triple, quadruple. But it would create economic shockwaves in the world economy that would probably dwarf those of the oil price hike of the 70s.
Is there anything that we could do now to reverse the greenhouse effect, if indeed we're experiencing the greenhouse effect? And as you pointed out, there's no absolute evidence of that, although all the scientists suspect that's what's happening.
Right. Some warming is now inevitable given the buildup of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that's already occurred. We've seen some exciting developments on the with CFCs, largely because of ozone depletion, as you know.
Those are the chlorofluorocarbons.
Chlorofluorocarbons, right. The conference in Europe a week ago, at that conference, most of the industrial countries agreed to phase out entirely the use of CFCs before the end of the century. Now, there were a number of developing countries that did not agree to that and said they needed help develop substitutes and so forth. But the countries that produce most of the CFCs in Europe and the United States and Japan have agreed to phase out. So that's an exciting advance, and that will help because CFCs are account for probably close to a fifth of the greenhouse effect. But the much more difficult thing will be to reestablish a carbon balance between the Earth and the atmosphere, and that means we have to cut way back on fossil fuel use. It means we think that we ought to be pushing for new automobiles by the end of the century that get at least 50 miles per gallon, and that this should become a worldwide standard, that everyone would push for that. It also means that we ought to plant a lot of trees in the next couple of decades because trees fix the carbon that comes from fossil fuels. And if we can plant enough trees, we can offset somewhat the continued use of fossil fuels while we're developing alternative sources of energy over the longer term.
Let me get back to the CFCs, those chlorofluorocarbons.
Mm-hmm.
If countries phase out things that use CFCs, mm-hmm. what will that mean to consumers? What won't we have, or what will be different for us?
Well, the most of the substitutes for CFCs in refrigerators, for example, cost more than the existing CFCs that are used. So this would mean that the cost of refrigerators will probably be somewhat higher as we phase out CFCs. On the other hand, the CFCs that we used in aerosol cans that we use for various household uses and cosmetics and so forth, they were phased out. They were banned in the United States back in the late 70s. And we easily made that switch and developed substitutes that were quite competitive in a cost sense. So in some cases, there won't be much change at all. In other cases, there will be increases in prices.
Lester Brown is my guest. He's the founder and president of the World Watch Institute, which is a Washington-based think tank which monitors the global environment, and they've just issued their annual report on the state of the world. Now, you were talking about cars, how to reverse the greenhouse effect. We'd have to have cars that didn't rely so heavily on fossil fuels. I remember people used to be talking about electronic cars, battery-operated cars. I don't think you hear much about that anymore.
Well, we haven't heard much lately, but we're probably going to hear a lot more in the future about alternative forms of transportation. From what we can see at the Institute as we look at the various environmental problems, the transport vehicle of the future may well have two wheels and not four. It may well be a bicycle. The bicycle is the one form of transportation that is responsible, that is responsive to almost all the environmental problems that we face today, such as climate change, acid rain, urban air pollution, traffic congestion, land scarcity in some countries. And what we've seen over the past several years is an enormous growth in the number of people in the world who have reached the level of bicycle affluence, if you will. This has been most dramatic in China and to a lesser degree in India. But last year, bicycle sales worldwide totaled about 105 million. That compares with 33 million automobiles. There may now be more people commuting to work by bicycle than by automobile, though that's obviously not the case in the United States.
You wrote the chapter in the State of the World report on reexamining world food prospects. And in the conclusion to your book, you say something that actually surprised me, which is that future food security may be more in the hands of family planners than farmers. Now, I actually thought that there was less international concern about population growth now than there had been 10 or 20 years ago.
I think that may be a correct perception, unfortunately. But it looks to us as though the food population balance is going to become increasingly precarious in the years ahead. So much so that food security may well replace military security as the principal preoccupation of many national governments in the world. What we're seeing is worldwide agricultural retrenchment. After the grain prices doubled in the early 70s following the Soviet wheat purchase in 1972, farmers and governments throughout the world sort of pulled out the stops in response to the high grain prices throughout the mid and late 70s and even into the early 80s. And this led to a lot of overplowing and overpumping. And what we've seen in the last few years is farmers pulling back in country after country, cutting back on cultivated area, abandoning the highly erodible land that should never have been plowed, and cutting back on irrigation because overpumping has lowered water tables in many key agricultural regions of the world, including, for example, the southern Great Plains of the United States, the North China Plain, many parts of India, parts of the Soviet Union as well. So we think that food may well be the issue of the 90s. The other thing that impresses us is that almost all the changes in the Earth's physical condition, that is the various forms of environmental deterioration, whether it's the buildup in greenhouse gases or soil erosion or the loss of biological diversity or ozone depletion or desertification or deforestation, almost all of these trends affect the world food prospect either directly or indirectly.
Now, when you're looking at future famines, do you think it's third world countries that will be most hard hit?
Well, if we were to sort of play out the what-if scenario we were talking about earlier, what if we have another severe drought in the United States this year, then the increase in grain prices that would result, whether it was a doubling, tripling, or whatever, would profoundly affect the third world. There are probably 1 to 1.5 billion people in the world who are already spending 70% of their income on food. And if the price were to double or triple, they obviously would be forced below the survival level. The political instability that would result from that would probably force the affluent countries to consider tapping the only remaining grain reserve in the world, which is the 450 million tons of grain fed to livestock each year. And then the question would be, how would we do that? What if we wanted to avoid widespread starvation and political instability in the third world by sharing our feed grain? Would we do that by imposing a meat tax, like a gasoline tax? Or would we adopt a rationing system of the sort that we used for sugar during World War II, for example? If we have a drought in this country this year, we're only months away from some profound political choices.
My guest is Lester Brown. He's president of the World Watch Institute, a Washington-based organization which monitors the global environment. Their State of the World 1989 report tracks deteriorating environmental conditions. And we'll talk more after this report, after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Lester Brown, founder of the World Watch Institute, and we're discussing their new State of the World Report 1989. Well, you've delivered some pretty bad news in the past few minutes. What's the good news in your report?
At the international level, by far the most exciting development has been the emerging consensus among the industrial countries that the use of chlorofluorocarbons, the gases that are depleting the ozone layer, should be phased out before the end of the century. That represents a major achievement for the entire world community. At the national level, probably the most exciting advance in the United States has been the progress made in reducing soil erosion as a result of the Conservation Reserve Program that was passed by Congress in December of 1985. We've probably reduced our soil erosion over the last 2 years by nearly one-third. That's a major achievement. It's becoming a model for other countries in the world to aspire to. On the family planning front, the big success story, of course, continues to be China, which is striving mightily to bring its population growth to a halt within the next couple of decades before it's overwhelmed by sheer numbers.
I was surprised that there isn't a chapter devoted to the oceans in your new report, especially in the year following the summer where a lot of us went on vacations and found that we couldn't swim or eat fish.
Right. We can only have about 10 chapters in a given year, and it's a matter of dealing with the issues that seem to be most important at the time. Those problems are not going away, and if you'll be patient, you may see a chapter on the oceans in, if not Stay the World 1990, then Stay the World 1991.
Environmental issues, I think, were issues that have been addressed for many years by grassroots groups and are now being addressed by governments around the world and in international forums. Do you think that there's any indication that grassroots groups have been effective in getting more governmental action on environmental issues?
Well, a lot of the things that have happened on the environmental front around the world have come from the work of grassroots groups. Certainly in this country, groups organizing in local communities have often been the key in forcing industrial plants to clean up their waste, for example, particularly when it involves the discharge of toxic chemicals. In India, probably the best known grassroots group is the so-called CHIPCO movement, the group that I suppose it's been at least a dozen years ago, where people, mostly women, began hugging the trees, literally, to prevent them from being cut down by the commercial loggers. These were local communities who realized that their long-term economic well-being depended on preserving the forest, because without the forest, the soils would wash away, and so would their livelihoods. So the CHIPCO movement has been very successful in northern India, not only in preventing deforestation, but more recently in organizing local tree planting efforts. In the Brazilian Amazon, the rubber tappers, those who live in the Amazon rainforest and who tap the natural rubber trees that grow there, have been organizing to established the concept of extractive reserves, that is land, parts of the Amazon that would be reserved only for the harvest of natural products, whether that be rubber or Brazil nuts or any of the dozens of other products that are produced naturally in the Amazon. Indeed, the leader of the rubber tappers, who was pioneering that concept, Chico Mendes, was assassinated just before Christmas this year. And partly because of his death, the attention focused on that effort and the pressures brought to bear on the Brazilian government suggest that we could make that group could make quite a bit of progress within the next year or two.
Now, I presume that you write the State of the World report not to make us feel hopeless or helpless, but for some other reason.
Well, if I were to sum up our reason for being as a research institute, it is to help raise the level of public awareness on important issues to the point where it will support an effective political response. And whether that political response is an international accord to phase out the use of CFCs or legislation passed by the U.S. Congress to reduce soil erosion in the United States, that's the kind of thing that we're hoping to foster through the research and analysis that we do in State of the World and through the dissemination of the research results. State of the World, incidentally, which will probably sell more than 100,000 copies in English in this country this year, is now going into all the world's major languages, including Spanish, Arabic, Chinese, Japanese, Javanese, German, Polish, Italian, French, Russian, for example, we'll probably do close to 250,000 copies worldwide. So the research and analysis is being used by policymakers and concerned citizens on every continent.
The reaction that a lot of people have to hearing the kind of news that you give us in the State of the World Report is, oh, God, well, you can't eat the food if there is any food. And, you know, there's a water crisis and there's wars around the world and people are dying of AIDS. Well, gosh, what's, you know, the world's miserable shape. What can anybody do about it? And it has the potential of just leaving you really depressed.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have suggestions for actions individuals can take?
Well, there's always a temptation to look for people who are concerned with what's happening to look for things that they can do, and they're often advised to, you know, recycle your newspapers or what have you. And those are not unimportant things, but I think we've reached the point where we have to, if we're concerned about what's happening, we have to become politically active and push for the things that need to be done, whether that's increasing the fuel efficiency of automobiles or moving towards smaller families or planting more trees or whatever. The things that need to be done are of such a scale that it's going to take an enormous effort, and it's not something that a few concerned citizens by themselves can do. We're going to have to mobilize the communications media, for example, for sort of a crash education of people throughout the world in what's happening to our environmental support systems. We now have, for the first time, members of the U.S. Congress introducing climate stabilization legislation that deal with everything from energy efficiency to family planning and getting the brakes on world population growth. So we're seeing progress here and there, but the mobilization that's going to be required to reverse the buildup in greenhouse gases, to reverse the deforestation of the earth and start increasing the earth's tree cover, to reestablish a balance between births and deaths in the world, to protect the ozone layer, to protect the enormous wealth of biological diversity on the planet, is going to take an effort that goes far beyond any recent experience that we've had. Probably the closest thing to it would be the mobilization of the Allied powers in the early 40s. In the early 40s, we went through an almost overnight transformation in this country because we were threatened, and that sense of threat was shared. And in fact, it took Pearl Harbor to actually bring that national mobilization into being, but it happened. We think, in a sense, we're already in World War III, and World War III is not a battle among nations. It's the war between ourselves and the natural systems on which we depend. We're quite literally destroying our environmental support systems, and the question is whether we can mobilize quickly enough to save our soils and to stabilize climate, to get the brakes on population growth, et cetera, before environmental deterioration in its many forms begins to undermine civilization as we know it.
Lester Brown, I thank you very much for sharing just a little bit of the research that you've done for the New State of the World Report.
Terry, I've enjoyed chatting with you.
Thank you for your time, and my guest has been Lester Brown, the president of the World Watch Institute, which follows global environmental trends. The World Watch Institute is based in Washington, D.C., and their State of the World 1989 report is published by Norton Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be Jonathan Yardley, Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic and columnist for The Washington Post. His new book is a family memoir. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tears on My Pillow, Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop, and Going Out of My Head were some of Little Anthony and the Imperials' hits in the 50s and 60s. On today's Fresh Air, we find out what Anthony's been up to since the Imperials broke up. Also, jazz pianist Kenny Barron returns in our weekly performance spot to play a composition inspired by South African composer Abdullah Ibrahim. And critic at large Laurie Stone examines the new traditionalism in advertising and the media. Laurie calls it selling safety and security with the rhetoric of rebellion. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Nora Rahm. News of another big jump in the producer price index sent stock prices down nearly 50 points on Wall Street today. Inflation on the wholesale level soared 1% in February for the second straight month. Michael Richards has details.
So far this year, the producer price index has risen at a 12.6% annual rate. That's more than triple the rate of inflation on the wholesale level registered last year. Independent economist Michael Evans says inflation is so widespread that he finds few bright spots in this latest report.
It's like the story of the kid who looked through all the horse manure and said, there has to be a pony in here somewhere. There are a few positive aspects. Farm prices have actually started to come down. Energy prices have peaked and are starting to come down. Eventually, these could be translated into more declines in food and energy prices at the wholesale and retail level. But I think this will take a while. The effect will be rather small.
So small that Evans sees inflation staying high for a while, and he says that means higher interest rates and less money for consumers to spend. All in all, an equation that usually leads to an economic downturn. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
The U.S. government announced today more inspections of fruit from Chile to allow the importation of Chilean fruit after a five-day moratorium. Frank Young, the commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, said it is impossible to assure 100% safety, but he's confident the additional safeguards will detect any hazardous substances.
For the present, FDA will make continued special inspections of the sample of these imported fruits. In addition, the Chilean government is instituting its own inspection system of outgoing fruit products. With these and other safeguards in place, we believe that this program will provide the maximum feasible safety for fruit from Chile.
The importation ban was imposed after two grapes from Chile were found to contain cyanide. Chilean fruit could be back on grocery store shelves in 5 to 9 days. Now that the immediate fruit crisis is over, Chilean government officials met with business leaders today to plan recovery measures. Tim Frasca reports.
Chilean head of state, General Augusto Pinochet, announced an emergency measure to provide financial aid to the country's fruit growers. The aid package is designed to offset losses estimated at $40 million per day that resulted from the five-day ban on Chilean fruit in the United States and other countries. Exporters are worried that despite the lifting of the ban, consumers' confidence in Chilean fruit has been shaken. One official of the Chilean Exporters Association predicted that it may take 2 years or more for sales to return to normal. Meanwhile, union officials said they expect all workers dismissed during the crisis to be rehired immediately. Before the agreement was reached, some 10,000 demonstrators, many of them fruit packers in their uniforms, massed outside the U.S. consulate in Santiago. At one point, police had to chase the angry crowd away from the entrance. For National Public Radio, this is Tim Frasca in Santiago.
The Senate today unanimously confirmed Dick Cheney as Secretary of Defense. Cheney was sworn in shortly after the vote in an informal ceremony at his congressional office and went immediately to the Pentagon to begin work. The Senate failed to act today on an extension of the federal program that currently provides the medicine AZT for AIDS patients. The Senate has begun a 2-week recess, and their inaction means the program will end at the end of the week. Stock prices fell sharply today on the news of a steep jump in wholesale prices in February. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 48 points to close at 2292.14. Declines led advances 7-1 on volume of 243 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 70 cents. This is National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz pianist Kenny Barron joins us again in our weekly performance spot with some music inspired by South African pianist and composer Abdullah Ibrahim.
That was a composition entitled Mountain Lesotho by one of my favorite pianists and composers, Abdullah Ibrahim. About 3 years ago, I had the chance to hear Abdullah Ibrahim at a club in New York called Sweet Basil's, playing a duet with saxophonist Carlos Ward. And the music they produced was so beautiful and prayerful. It was like being in a temple or a church. It was very, very lyrical, very sweet music, very blissful music. And it inspired me to write this next composition, one of mine, entitled Song for Abdullah.
Thank you.
Kenny Barron is featured on the latest recording by Sphere, titled Bird Songs. Next week, Kenny Barron plays the music of Thelonious Monk. This is Fresh Air. We noticed Little Anthony was singing in a New York club, and we wondered what he'd been doing since his hits of the 50s and 60s. So we invited him to NPR's New York Bureau to tell us. Little Anthony and the Imperials stayed together until the mid-70s. Anthony has been out on his own since. The group had their first big hit in 1958 with the song Tears on My Pillow. Other hits included Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop, Hurt So Bad, I'm on the Outside, and this song.
Well, I think I'm going out of my head. Yes, I think I'm going out of my head over you. Over you. I want you to want me. I need you so badly. I can't think of anything. Walk past me, you don't even know that I exist. Going out of my head over you. Out of my head over you. Out of my head. Day and night, night and day and night. All right, I must be going away.
I wanted to know what kind of songs Little Anthony is doing now.
Well, I sing all kinds of songs, contemporary today songs. Sometimes I think people think that the only song that I can sing is Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop. No. No. I do everything from Stevie Wonder to Michel Legrand to Foreigner to Larry Graham, Temptations, you name it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Has the range of your singing voice changed?
Well, when I was a child of 16 or 17 years old, obviously I was a total natural tenor. I am a tenor, but I have developed a resonance in my voice. In other words, I can cover different ranges, which makes me a better singer. I'm a better singer now than I was then. You should be. Simply because of experience, learning how to use your instrument. Learning how to turn notes and cover rhythms and all those kind of things. If you're interested in learning and being current and listening and growing, then those things should happen. You should be a better singer. I should be a better singer when we work at it.
I should have ever been a good singer.
Yeah, well, anybody should be better at anything they do when they work at it.
When you were younger, were you ever self-conscious about having a high voice?
You know, I never thought about it. I thought I heard this once that you can't really tell how you sound. You ever have one of those tape recorders, you know, and then you tape yourself and then you hear it and you say, that's not me.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I never really knew. It wasn't until it was brought to my attention by other people that I had a high voice or a feminine type voice, sounding voice.
And what was your response to that when you realized that?
I don't remember what my response was or what I felt at that time. It probably didn't even bother me. I think what bothers me is when I call on the phone and I ask an operator for something, some information, and she said, yes, ma'am. That bothers me.
What kinds of places have you been singing in the past few years?
Well, just about everywhere. I've done everything. I mean, there was a span of time since 1975 that I look back at, and I say to myself, Anthony, you have been through a lot of things, and you've done a lot, and you've seen a lot of things. You've done a lot of things. I've done the revival circuit. I call it revival circuit because I detest the word oldies. For some reason, it sounds like some molded piece of bread somewhere. and I've acted in several plays. I have done television. I have done just about everything since the Imperials and I came to an end.
And that was in 1974 that you broke up with the Imperials.
Well, actually, it was 75.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
I remember. You don't forget something like that. Mm-hmm. It was September of 1975.
Why'd you break up?
Because we'd gone as far as we could. I think we were wise enough to realize when it was time to know when to quit. I mean, we were together for 17 years. And I can't think of anything more sadder than seeing some group grow old, you know. So it seemed appropriate to call it a day. I never say we broke up. I always say we came to an end because we didn't fight or argue, and that's what caused the breakup. We just decided to call it a day. We picked a year. 1975, that's it. And I think it was a good thing.
How did you first form the group and get together with the guys who became known as the Imperials?
Well, first of all, I didn't form the group. It was Clarence Collins
that
did, one of the Imperials. And we all lived in the projects in Brooklyn. He had a group called the Chesters. And I was doodling around with lots of groups, and I was in a group called the DuPonts in Boys High School in Brooklyn. And you know, when your kids in those days, they used to have all these contests. They would have talent contests all over the place. And sometimes my group was pitted up against his group. And I always liked the way they sounded, you know. I did. I secretly hovered this wish deep into the deeper part of my soul that I wanted to be with that group. So off and on, Clarence and I would talk about it, and finally one day, somewhere back there in ancient time, I said, well, why don't I come with you guys? And he told me, he says, yeah, we wanted you to come with us for a long time. So I left the DuPonts and I went with the Chesters. Now, that was the beginning of the Imperials.
The first record you recorded was Tears on My Pillow. This
mm-hmm.
was in 1958.
And that wasn't supposed to be the record that was supposed to be the single at all.
What was supposed to be the B-side?
It wasn't even in the repertoire songs that we were singing and recording.
Oh, so how did you end up doing it?
Well, George came in, and he didn't like one of the songs, as I remember. And one of the songs was Cha-Cha Henry. When you think about it, as I think about it, I know why he didn't like that song. Yeah. Well, anyway, he said, well, you know, that's, guys, it just doesn't do anything for me. Listen, there's a song that was brought over to my office, and it's called Tears on My Pillow. And I want you guys to listen to it, go in a room, you know, at the studio, and listen to it and see what you can do with it, and we're going to record it today. And we listened to it, and I caught the melody. I have a gift. I don't know what it is or why. I remember melodies very easily. And so all I had to do was read the lyric. The Imperials couldn't come up with something good. You know, they wanted to come up with something intricate, but time eluded us. We couldn't do it. So we borrowed a background. And the background that we borrowed was from a song called Earth Angel. And the background was, ooh, 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 hence Tears in My Pillow. Same thing. Ooh, ooh. See, you learned something, see?
That's a great story.
Yeah, it's true.
But I remember you. 'Twas not so long ago. You broke my heart in two. Tears on my pillow. Pain in my heart caused by you. If we could start anew, I'd gladly take you back and tempt the hand.
Anthony is performing at the Ballroom in New York until March 25th. Little Anthony and the Imperials' hits from the 50s and 60s have been reissued on compact disc. Part two of our conversation with Little Anthony on our next program. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. What story is he following, Robert?
Well, we'll be following up on today's report of a relatively high inflation rate and what the stock market did in response to that. We will also be talking with Washington lawyer John Neils, who was a counsel to the Iran-Contra Committee, about the evidence that's come out this week in the Oliver North trial of President Reagan's involvement in what was illegal at the time, aid to the Contras, and how what we've learned this week might alter what we knew from the committee investigation. We will also be hearing about Stephen Boggs, the man who draws currency. He was the subject of a big New Yorker magazine piece. He's arrested in Australia, charged with counterfeiting.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Some people say that we live in a time in which traditional gender roles no longer exist, but critic at large Laurie Stone thinks they may just be thinly disguised.
Have you seen the Ladies' Home Journal ad selling the new traditionalist? Listen to some copy. Quote, "She started a revolution with some not-so-revolutionary ideals. She's the contemporary woman who has made a new commitment to the traditional values that some people thought were old-fashioned. She wasn't following a trend. She made her own choices." Unquote. This is newspeak. Reaction is revolution. Surrendering independence is a measure of independence. But the hyping of safety and security with the rhetoric of protest is more widespread than these ads, and it's an insidious sell, at once exploiting and eclipsing genuine rebellion and risk-taking. Talk show celebrities like Valerie Harper and Dr. Ruth, who used to glorify personal freedom, now sermonize about clean living and the supremacy of the family. For a while, the cover for moralism was AIDS, but now these values are extolled for their own sake. The message is, it's hip to be square, but hip has to mean what it's always meant, living on the edge, struggling with decisions that have consequences in the world and can jeopardize safety. No one is content to describe themselves as reactionary, fearful, panicked, or simply desiring of safety and security. There's nothing shameful about wanting security, and if it were stated straight out, it would be palatable. Instead, it's valorized as mature, advanced. The TV show 30-something is a prime purveyor of new traditionalism. Rock music, hairstyles, and slang are meant to cue us to accept the characters as opponents of the status quo. In fact, they only affect the style of rebellion. They've risked nothing, then look back nostalgically and condescendingly on radical choices they never made. Michael, who works in advertising, has to decide between running his own company and working for a larger firm, and the conflict is played as if his soul and integrity were on the line. Again and again, characters conclude it's folly to have radical ideals, as foolish as long hair and bell-bottoms. It's mature to live in the suburbs. It's bold for women to forego careers and be the sole caretakers of kids. Equally trivializing of protest is Wendy Wasserstein's play The Heidi Chronicles, which recently moved to Broadway and purports to portray feminists. Heidi is described as a true believer, although she rejects the word feminist in favor of humanist, as if fighting for women's rights were a diminishment. Wasserstein depicts consciousness-raising groups as treacly coffee klatches, when, more accurately, they could be lampooned for grandiosity and backbiting. We don't hear a word about the issues that have motivated feminism. Abortion rights, child care, equal pay, domestic violence. And although Heidi doesn't know why she makes the choices she does, and none of them seems a consequence of the women's movement, when she says she's unhappy, the play asks, did feminism let her down? It doesn't ask, why is society still making it so hard for women? It doesn't say that no movement can solve all of one's problems, especially one that's reviled and stymied by the establishment. Would anyone dare suggest that the civil rights movement promised minorities too much and is therefore to blame for middle-aged disappointment minorities may feel? At the end of the play, Heidi adopts a baby, and the play says this will make her happy. When all is said and done, not work or friendship or sex are crucial in order for a woman to feel whole and contented. A baby is the answer. It seems I've heard this somewhere before.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, we continue our conversation with Little Anthony, and he tells us how he made the transition from doo-wop to orchestrated production. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from pianist Connie Crothers and saxophonist Lenny Popkin. And television critic David Bianculli previews Peter Pan. NBC is rebroadcasting their 1960 production, starring Mary Martin as the boy who never grew up. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Peter Murdoch. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.